thanks to Amber and Rachel for inviting me. I don't actually know how much I know about integrity. but I do know something about Simone Weil. I'm very happy to be here and talk with you today. I'm sorry I haven't been before, so I don't know clearly what kind of discussion you'd like to have. So I propose just to kind of make a 15-minute introduction to Simone Weil mainly, and not so much the works. And then depending on what your interests are, we can dig into the works or dig into some of the issues raised by the works according to your interests. I will make one proposal for a very direct point of contact between Weil and integrity. So I'll start with her life, I suppose. Most of you will know that she was relatively short-lived. She lived 34 years. She was born before the First World War and died during the Second World War. So she was very much shaped by that strange interwar period when there were quite a lot of things happening. For example, the labor movement was something she was very much involved with. And we'll come back to that in a minute. The concept of work and labor is something which is central to her philosophy, and in that sense, it's quite unusual. There aren't very many people who have given much philosophical thought to the concept of labor or the concept of work. I suppose if I give you just some biographical facts about her. She was born in Paris. She was Jewish. There's some debate about, if you like, how Jewish she was. But it seems pretty clear from the account that her niece gave that it was a sort of a modern humanist house that still kept most of the Jewish holidays. I think yesterday was Rosh Hashanah, which is Jewish New Year, so maybe it's apt, I don't know. But in any case, she certainly was not raised a Christian, not raised especially in a secular way. She was raised in a Jewish cultural context. She had about as good an education as the French could give you. She did very well and eventually went up to the École Normale, where she studied under a fellow whose pen name was Alain, and who gave her the sort of problem which in some ways set the agenda for her philosophy, and this was the idea of what it is to be active. And this led partially to her interest in work and labor, but it also led her in particular to conceptions of being active that aren't necessarily to do with action. So she had a notion of activity which wasn't automatically connected with bodily movement or action. Indeed, this eventually led to probably the concept for which, in philosophical circles, she's had the most impact, which is the notion of attention, which we'll come back to, which was a form of activity, but a form of activity that wasn't, if you like, action in the normal sense of the term. She did very well at the École Normale. However, she was very odd. Her supervisor called her the Martian. And she was a communist and not much fun to hang around. And so her classmates called her the Red Virgin because of this cape that she wore as she went around the campus. One of the things that's notable about her is she appears to have had no romantic life at any point in her life. There aren't even rumors. She had a kind of what some people have described as sort of fanatical asceticism, and to some extent denied the body, but also seems, despite having written a great deal about love, she certainly didn't have in mind erotic love, both in terms of her thinking or in terms of her own personal experience. The other thing that's, I think, important, because she's very well known for her spiritual writings, is that she was trained as a philosopher. All the way through. She was trained in the sort of split between analytical and continental philosophy wasn't so pronounced then. Her focus was Descartes and then Plato. She'd learned Greek by age 12. She was pretty precocious and was very good with languages. In any case, so she was trained in philosophy, and her first job when she finished was as a philosophy teacher. So she spent several years as a teacher of philosophy in secondary schools in France. While she was doing that, she was in the labor movement. She was generally on the left-wing side of politics, and she was very demonstrative in the ways that the forms that her activism took were visible. What I mean by that is she would show up in some relatively small French town as the secondary school teacher of philosophy. French still had the good sense then and still have the good sense to teach philosophy in secondary school. And so she would teach philosophy, but she would also, for example, set up philosophy lessons for working people. And so she'd have those on the side, or she would march side by side with the workers over some sort of protest. Now, given that she was coming from Paris, coming from this prestigious university, and was quite clearly in her appearance and her diction from a privileged background, there was something slightly scandalous about this, and to sort of visibly take an interest in the working poor or the working class was already to court controversy. And the controversy came, and she was frequently asked to leave the school at the end of the school year. So she worked at several of them, mostly because they didn't want her to stay on, although those of her students that people have spoken to since say she was a very good teacher and very attentive, and some of her lectures survive in the form of notes taken by her students. And those are available as lectures in philosophy. They're quite interesting. There's a lot of Plato in them and a lot of epistemology, a lot of the sort of epistemology of knowledge versus opinion, as you might expect if there was a kind of Platonic structure to it. She stopped teaching after a few years. From very early on, she had poor health. She was prone to migraines, prone to fatigue, and she was notoriously clumsy. She stopped teaching, and she took a trip to Germany to see the labor movement in Germany. And while she was there, she became very disillusioned with the labor movement, although not at this point for reasons of internal contradiction. Rather, she realized how weak the labor movement was. She saw the strength of the German government and the way that it was responding to the labor movement, and she realized that they would never succeed. The labor movement would never achieve its aims. That confronted with the idea of government to some extent and the fact of government meant that she thought that it would never succeed. So this kind of political dimension of her work, seeing the ways in which a collective like the government, but actually later also a collective like the union, the kind of strength that it had, the kind of ways in which it used language against people, these became themes in her work from that point on. And she changed her view. She went from having been a pacifist to endorsing a kind of limited cases where force, she thought, was the only way that some types of justice could be achieved. So she believed in a kind of righteous use of force. And like many of her contemporaries, she saw the opportunity of the Spanish Civil War as an opportunity to put left-wing ideology into battle with right-wing ideology. She went down as a volunteer. She tried to volunteer for many very dangerous missions and joined a kind of group that specialized in commando operations. But her colleagues quickly realized that she was very clumsy and of no good with a rifle. And so they contrived to prevent her from going on missions until eventually she stepped into a cooking pot and burned her foot rather badly and was left the battlefield. So she It's not clear if she ever saw any combat, but she placed herself in harm's way, was forever volunteering for very dangerous missions, but ultimately didn't really do anything. But while the time in Spain was formative, because she saw the behavior of both sides, and that's when I suppose I think her first really deep idea came, and that was she came to see force as something that couldn't be used righteously, that force corrupts those who use it as much as those who suffer from force. And that gave rise to this magnificent essay of hers, which I could easily have set. And this is a particularly handsome edition, the Iliad, or the Poem of Force, of which there are several translations. That one's very nice for having a lot of the Greek aspects of the Iliad brought out. But there's another one which I put in the text for the website, which is the Mary McCarthy translation, and it pairs it with a piece by Rachel Bespalov. It's a fantastic essay, and I have to mention one more thing about it, because it comes up in some of the things that we read today. She thought the Iliad a really remarkable piece of literature. And what she thought remarkable about it was not, if you like, its literary or artistic qualities per se. It was, to her mind, remarkable because of the way that it reflected on this battle and treated with compassion and pity both the victors and the losers, or the victors and the vanquished. And she felt that the Iliad presented a picture of everybody who was involved as a victim. And she felt that that was both a remarkable thing to do for somebody who was reasonably contemporary, and also remarkable that somebody who was, in a sense, on the winning side could see that the winning side had been as debased by the use of force as those who had been destroyed by the use of force. So that idea of overturning a very natural response of the victor over the vanquished, and finding the compassion to see the two as the same, she thought, kind of an achievement of the Iliad, which became itself a kind of gift to posterity. So she uses the Iliad very often in that sense. And the ability to overcome the natural reaction of, triumph, for example. When she speaks of the supernatural, she often just has in mind, if you like, overcoming the natural tendency. For example, upon being struck, having the desire to want to strike back, or even in some cases, to feel resentment. To overcome that seems almost mad in a natural sense of the term. But the ability to do so, which she thinks is sometimes possible, is what she sometimes calls supernatural. So it's not quite as mystical a term as it might appear when you first read it. And one way to think of it is that the material out of which we are made, if you like, has a certain kind of logic. If you like, there's a kind of mechanics, in Newton's sense, to being flesh and blood. Again, it's a very Greek sort of theme that we struggle with the fact that we have form and matter, and that form and matter, to some extent, dictates the mechanics of how we respond. And overcoming it, sometimes, when we do, is this remarkable kind of achievement of which humans are capable. In any case, the other thing that happened was, while she was recovering from the Spanish Civil War, she had the first of several mystical experiences, which inclined her towards the spiritual, inclined her towards religion, and specifically religion in a vaguely Christian form. And I say this because, although she's very much known for her writings on spirituality and her extolling of, for example, Christ's example, she wasn't really a very competent Christian in one sense. First of all, she never joined a church or a particular sect, but more importantly, she found the resurrection of no interest whatsoever. It was really the crucifixion and what led up to the crucifixion that was what she found impressive. And I think if you're a Christian who's not interested in the resurrection, looking a little defective, or at least incomplete. You know, it's certainly right to say that she was inspired by Christ's example in the New Testament, but not necessarily the narrative, the full narrative, if you like. So, having had these mystical experiences, a new strand was injected into her writing and into her thinking, and she became more receptive to speaking about humans in terms of their spiritual qualities, not just their active qualities. However, by this point, things in Europe had started to go downhill. The Second World War had started. And eventually, she went to New York because she knew her parents wouldn't leave France without her. And she very much wanted her parents to leave. So she went to New York and spent a short time in New York before moving to London, where she worked for the Free French government. Although she had more or less no friends, although people found her very difficult and very awkward, although you know not very many people wanted to spend time talking to her, people understood that she was possessed of a piercing intellect and a kind of uncompromising manner, which meant that she would pursue a debate or an idea irrespective of what pieties, social pieties, intellectual pieties, it might overturn. And in general, she wasn't very interested in playing the game of recognition. So although she wasn't very well connected in one sense, her intelligence was recognized from essays she had written in the interwar years. And so de Gaulle, who couldn't stand her, de Gaulle found a place that she a place was found for her in the Free French government, and it was to think about what France should be like after the war, to come up with a blueprint for a just and decent society built out of the ashes of France. Now, I can't imagine any of them had any intention of doing what she had in mind. I still think it's interesting that they commissioned her to do this. This was, they offered her this job instead of her own job, which was to parachute behind enemy lines with combat-trained nurses and supply nursing behind enemy lines to people working against the Germans. Now, what's again is important is that her work was shaped very much by the conflict of the Second World War and by the rise of fascist ideology, which, of course, in Germany, let's say, began in 1933. So they'd already had a run of years, even before the war had started, to see this. I think that's enough about her life. I think I've mentioned to you that she worked as a school teacher. She worked as a trade unionist. She also did one very unusual thing. All of this thinking about labor, she felt that she lacked a certain authority to speak about this. There she was working in the labor movement, talking about the suffering of those given undignified work. And she addressed this in part by going and working at a Renault factory as a factory worker. Well, first she worked in a garment factory and at a Renault factory at seriously unskilled labor. Given that she was both unskilled and clumsy, this labor was very difficult, and the year that she spent working in industry shattered her health for about another year. But she did get the experience, and the experience very much marked her, and she often spoke about the experience of working at Renault as having been marked as a slave. And for somebody as steeped in the Greek culture and philosophy as she was, for her to say something like that was probably the kind of allusion to the Greek idea that when a man becomes a slave, he loses half his soul. And so she for her to say this was not to say it lightly. She wrote essays throughout most of her adult life. Some of them were published in intellectual journals or left-wing journals. She kept some notebooks during the time before she went to New York and left those behind. And those were spiritual reflections mainly. She also wrote quite a few letters. None of the work that got her the notoriety she enjoyed later was published during her lifetime. So almost everything was published posthumously. And beginning first with those notebooks, which were, as I say, spiritual reflections. So initially, the impact that she had was for her spiritual reflection and sort of her uncompromising take on certain aspects of Christian theology. Later, others of other parts of her work were published in French, and also a lot of it was translated into English. And she sort of came to prominence in the 50s and 60s. I'd like to suggest to you we can divide her work to some extent into spiritual writings, political writings, and philosophical writings. And the things that I've suggested we read for today probably fall more into the political and philosophical side, but especially the political, I guess. The two pieces I chose for us to read, I partially chose them because I thought they were a reasonable length. Human Personality is one of her, probably the most famous of her non-spiritual writing. I think it's been justly picked out as one of the most distinctive. It's one of the ones which has endured. Not everybody. In many ways, the familiarity with her spiritual writing has declined. But with regard to her political and philosophical writing, Human Personality, which has been published under different names, by the way, it was published in Britain once under the title The Fallacy of Human Rights, which was not her title. But I think it gives you an idea of how it was initially perceived. I also selected it because I think it's an important piece. It's a very concentrated dose of a lot of the concepts that she worked on and concepts that she presented. Concepts of attention, affliction, justice, all of these are present in this work. Also, the two pieces that we've got are from very late in her writings. So it represents, I think, her mature work in that sense. And the reason I chose the second, apart from the fact that I think it's good, this is the Are We Struggling for Justice, is that I think to some extent the second piece functions as an application of some of the ideas in the first. So insofar as there's something more practical or down-to-earth in Simone Weil's work, I suppose I think that Are We Struggling for Justice is a good application of that. A couple more things to say. One was, she had a very big influence on Iris Murdoch. I would say that the majority of Iris Murdoch's very good work bears the mark of Simone Weil, and much of it really is just Simone Weil's ideas, but given a different, more tractable form, and also made to interact with some of the prevailing philosophical theories of Murdoch's day. She also had a very big influence on those members of the Swansea School of Wittgenstein studies who were interested in ethics. So through people like Rush Rhys and Peter Winch, her work assumed a certain kind of role, I think in part because it was perceived rightly to be very much compatible with a certain kind of Platonic moral philosophy that people like Roy Holland, who was also part of the Swansea School, favored. Now, with regard to the paper Human Personality, one way of making the connection with integrity, I think, is this. In that paper, Human Personality, she's concerned to make a distinction between the personal and the impersonal. This is quite an unusual distinction, and it's certainly an unusual way to use the word impersonal. Maybe it feels less unusual in French than it does in English. But in any case, the sort of thing that she wants to say about the personal is that it includes those things that make us individuals. So, for example, our peculiar desires, the contents of our imaginations, our fantasies, our perspective, and to some extent our material condition. The fact that some of us might be short or tall, or able or disabled. And she, as you will know, argues against the significance of anything to do with us as individuals for a sense of what is, I would put it this way, though she doesn't do it, of what is injured when we wrong someone. So she puts it very much in terms of when we do an injustice to someone. But I think if we want to relate it more naturally to the way we speak about morality and ethics, we might say, what is it that suffers when we're wronged? And she has in mind to say that it's the impersonal. And the impersonal, she thinks, picks out a category of things which in no way, if you like, are the creations of individuals. So the true, the good, love, beauty, and indeed things like mathematics and geometry, where she thinks, if you like, in some sense, mathematics and geometry are there to be discovered or revealed or understood, but nobody has created them, even when, for example, so-and-so is the first person to prove thus and such about geometry. And so the connection I want to suggest here is that on at least one understanding of integrity, I'd want to suggest that integrity was impersonal. I say this in this way. I looked for a definition of integrity in Webster's 1913 dictionary. It seems that they made dictionaries had more content earlier, or at least Webster's did. And one of the definitions was moral soundness, honesty, and freedom from corrupting influence or motive. So I took it to be a kind of, one way to put it would be, sort of like the opposite of having a conflict of interest, or to use Kant's terminology to talk about being disinterested. And in some sense, the person with integrity is capable of acting in a disinterested way, that is to say, serving no interest of his or her own. So, top line, my suggestion is a great point of contact would be the thought that integrity is impersonal in Simone Weil's way, Simone Weil's sense of impersonal. And I think that hits against certain other notions of integrity. I don't think it's compatible with, for example, integrity connected with a certain kind of perhaps heroism, a kind of standing up against things in one sense. I don't think that's a natural fit, although they might be reconciled. But I certainly think it's also very much opposed to a form of cod integrity, I would say, which is the idea of integrity as some variation on to thine own self be true. So insofar as somebody, I want to suggest that on Vey's outlook, that motto, to thine own self be true, would be a kind of caricature of integrity as she would see it. Certainly in a caricature of integrity if integrity is impersonal. With regard to her own life, I think that she was absolutely uncompromising, and that she was unwilling to bend to any kind of corruption as she saw it, intellectual corruption, to for example, the corruption of intellectual vanity, the corruption of recognition. So although it's sometimes said that, for example, Wittgenstein was, unflinchingly honest and sort of uncorruptible, he was in fact pretty vain in a lot of ways, and certain kinds of flattery would work with him in a way that makes that wouldn't work with Simone Weil, and in that way I think makes her seem I've already mentioned sort of fanatically ascetic. She writes with a certain kind of tendentious certainty. And Susan Sontag put it this way, that she was a person who is excruciatingly identical with her ideas. I think Sontag meant that as a sort of a mixed praise. But she also said, and here I think it's meant as praise full stop, that she was an uncompromising and troubling witness to the modern travail of the spirit. And I think there I'm inclined to agree with her. So I think I'll stop there.